RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
My guest today is the product designer and architect, Kim Collin. Along with her partner, Sam Heck, she is one half of the successful consultancy Industrial Facility, now in its 16th year. The work produced ranges from clocks, chairs and ceramics, to telephones, lighting and cutlery, and much more. All of the work has a carefully considered, stripped-back essence, but everything retains a simple beauty derived from intelligent design thinking. For Kim, it has been a long journey from her birthplace in San Jose, California. As a bespectacled seven-year-old, she suffered jibes at school, which sent her to withdraw into an invented world of her own. Armed with pencils, paints and brushes, she would while away the hours drawing and painting. Her father was an engineer and mother a psychologist, and both encouraged her innate creativity. But it was her grandmother who opened her eyes to the world of modern art through regular trips to museums and galleries. She fell in love with what she saw, and it became the catalyst for her future creative life. I spoke to Kim at Industrial Facilities' pristine studio in a discreet side street in London's Clerkenwell. I was curious to know more about that little glasses-wearing seven-year-old, and I asked her what that time was like.
The therapist asked me what I got out of having poor eyesight as a child, and what was the benefit, because normally you think of it really as a curse. You get called names, and it's cumbersome, and you have to remember your glasses, etc. But he said, what did I get from it? What was the good thing that I got from it? And actually, the image that came to me was that I was able to be left alone to do my artwork. No one bothered me because I was wearing glasses and no one wants to talk to a kid with glasses. So I could have that time to myself to do my own whatever I was doing. In the image, I had myself painting.
How old were you at that time?
I think about seven. But I didn't have this revelation until my mid-20s about my eyesight, that it was actually something that left me focus on my own work. I didn't have to socialize, so I could actually do things that I enjoyed, and that was artwork at that time. So I know my mom always says, oh, you were a very artistic kid, and I had this cupboard full of materials, and you were always experimenting, but I don't really remember that, but I remembered it when asked this question about my eyesight.
Did you feel alienated from your friends?
No, I felt like I was allowed to have the time to do something on my own, that I didn't have the burden of having to go out to play or having to socialize or do things that other people wanted me to, that I was actually allowed to have my own time at my easel.
So you had a creative energy when you were quite young?
It was there very young, and I had one of my grandmothers really encouraged it. She had an education in art history. She collected modern art. She was very aesthetic. She had a background in fashion. And I think she really fostered and encouraged my developing aesthetic, I would say.
So she latched onto you?
Yeah, she really did. Yeah, she took me to places. She took me when I was very, very young to a museum in Pasadena, which is normally a very conservative community. She took me to the Norton Simon Museum, mm-hmm. which was at that moment very revolutionary. It was showing outrageous work for Pasadena. She took me to a Klaus Oldenburg show when he was showing his inflatables. I absolutely loved it. Yeah. So for me, you know, this isn't someone who took me to see classical artwork. She was showing me work of the moment, yeah. and I really related to it. I found it really exciting, and I thought, to me, that was art. You know, that was so. My conception of art was not to look at old masters at all. My parents and grandparents had a collection of modern art, and obviously my grandmother was very influential.
Were you very academic at school?
No, I was very academic, actually. But by the time I was 11 and we moved back to Los Angeles, we moved from Dallas to Los Angeles. Wow. And at that time, Dallas was very conservative in that I was a girl, I had to wear a skirt, I had to wear, not a uniform, but it was a state school, but I had to wear a strict outfit. And by the time I moved to California, you know, there were boys in my class who had long hair and bell bottoms. It was very kind of hippie, and I found LA very, very different. But I was put in a class that luckily was part of an experiment going on at the time, and the experiment was to use my school and my particular class and another inner city school in Los Angeles, that particular class, to work with a group of young architects. And the young architect happened to be Doreen Nelson, And she's the sister of Frank Gehry. I didn't know that until many years later. And she was running a program it was kind of a social experiment to find out if kids from different economic circumstances, how they behave given kind of creative freedom. We each had a plot of land and had to come up with a architectural proposal for that piece of land and make a city.
How old were you then?
I was 11. So that was the first time I learned the word architect. So I learned the word architect when I was 11, and that's what I decided I wanted to be. I had such a great experience with these young designers and the whole process, and I absolutely loved it. But it took me quite a long path getting to that. I have an architecture master's degree. Yeah. I didn't do it as a bachelor's degree, for instance. Right. I took the long way around. But I knew that word was what I wanted, and I also understood architecture as a certain thing from that experiment. In other words, when I was looking as an undergraduate to perhaps get a BA in architecture, and it was a very technical application, it was a very technical degree, it was very dry, there seemed to be no art to it, it didn't appeal to me at all. But that didn't stop me from pursuing architecture, I just knew that wasn't the degree I wanted.
What was it about this bunch of people? Was it a different way of thinking?
Yeah, I think they asked different kinds of questions than you were ever asked in school. In school you were asked to tell them back what they had told you. They, for the first time, were asking me to make something they had never seen before, that I had never seen. Invent. Yes, if you want I made a giant bird hotel. It was literally shaped like a giant bird. And they said, yes, go for it. Let's make the model. You know, how will we make it? Out of what materials? I didn't know. I just went on that path of discovering it by making it. And it was completely, and everyone had really different proposals. Some people just didn't know what to do, put their hand down, traced it, and, you know, extruded it up and made a giant building. You know, everyone did different, really different things, but to put them all down and see them as a cityscape was really fantastic.
So the experiment clearly worked for you.
I think it did. Well, I went from that school, which was very, just that one class was the most interesting thing about that school. But I went from there to a private girls' school from 7th grade until university. I mean, that was very rigorous academically, and I really liked that. I didn't mind the work, I didn't mind the rigor. But I found, I think when I was about 15... I found it really strange to be in a school only with girls, and I thought it was very unrealistic because that's not the way our world is. And so I said to my parents, I don't want to go there anymore. And they said, well, find an alternative. So at 15, I looked around at other schools, and I made an appointment to go see co-ed private school. And it was just starting at the time. Now it's well established in Los Angeles and very, very respected. We went to go see it, and it was way too liberal for my parents. We can't pay a lot of money for that. I mean, there were sexually transmitted disease posters on the walls.
Right.
And, you know, it was very open. The kids smoked and called their teachers by their first name. My parents were not going to pay for that.
Right.
And they gave me a choice. They said, you can go to the local state school, which actually they had gone to. It was the same high school my parents had gone to. Or you can stay in the girls' school. And the local state school really scared me, partly because it was just giant.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have known one person there. So I said, okay, begrudgingly, I'll stay where I am and, you know, make the best out of it. And I did. And it was incredible education. And luckily I stayed there because I had one teacher who was really influential. He was teaching film studies for the 60s. The first one was the 1960s and 70s, and then the 70s to the 80s. It was an extension of a kind of English class or writing class. It was critical theory. It was critical thinking.
Yeah.
And he absolutely made me write in a way that I had never been asked to write before. That got me through my undergraduate education, what he taught me when I was 16 and 17. And that made me stay at that school.
So were you an avid reader at the time? Were you writing? Or did he just...
I didn't read that much literature, no. But I've always been I was always looking around at what was happening right then. So exhibitions, especially visual arts exhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taken to a lot of them with my parents. My parents were really interested in that too. So I never rebelled against that part. I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the looking. And I wanted to know, once he kind of opened the door to really thinking about films in an analytical way, I began to diagram how things were laid out and power structures and how narratives played out in films. So yes. Apply my literature thinking to a visual narrative, and I really enjoyed that. So I've always been very...
How was it that you didn't move into that direction? Because you obviously sound very enthused,
well,
enthused
I,
by it.
Yeah, I am, but I also grew up, you know, LA is driven by the Hollywood industry, yeah. And my parents are not in it, thankfully, and I had no desire to be in it at all. In fact, I really, by the time I was 17, wanted to get out of Los Angeles because I thought it was just way too materialistic and excessive, and I went to University of Washington. I wanted to go to a school like UCLA, but I grew up right next to it, and instead I went to University of Washington in Seattle just to get the size and breadth of UCLA,
right.
But not in my hometown, because I wanted to get away from the entertainment industry. It was kind of gross. And I lasted there 2 years, not as long. I thought it would be the perfect respite from LA. I actually felt very out of place there, because Seattle was then a great town. Boeing had driven it. I thought there must be, you know, it was prosperous. It was a beautiful place to live. There was, the visual culture there was so antiquated and so unadvanced and so uninteresting at that time.
Really.
Music culture, performance culture, outstanding. Visual culture, they were like painting seasides in the way that any little town might be doing. I think now it's gone beyond, but it wasn't for me.
Later, of course, you spent 9 years, combination of your BA,
yeah,
and your master's.
Yeah.
So that's a hell of a long
time. It is a
time,
long time,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So you did art history.
Yeah.
For your BA.
Yeah, I came back to UCLA and I did my art history degree, and yeah. I took as many classes in fine arts as I could, and in the architecture department as I could. So I studied in architecture under Thomas Hines, who was writing a book on Richard Neutra, which got me into the Neutra archive, became an assistant on that book. And I studied with Charles Jenks, who was teaching postmodernism at that time at UCLA, and in the fine arts department with Chris Burden and his wife Nancy Rubens, who just had a big show here at Gagosian actually many years later. But it was a really terrific education.
Where were you living? You were living...
I was living, yeah. I lived all over LA
all over
as a renter.
Place.
I tried every place close to downtown, close to Dodger Stadium, Venice Beach,
yep.
West Hollywood, Beverly Hills, everywhere. Why not, right? I really wanted and because I always had, I had a car since I was 16, so yeah, I had ultimate freedom to go anywhere
yes.
in the city.
It was that was just, the thing that really bugged me about America, is that kids had cars at 16.
Yeah, it's unfathomable.
I mean, it's just crazy.
It really
and
is.
And not just cars, big cars.
No, big cars.
People have mopeds here if they were lucky.
Yeah, it's true. Freedom, and there was still the freedom on the road to be able to have. I studied a lot about the surrealists and the situationists, who do something which is called the derive, where you walk through a city and you have this wander. And they talked about doing that in Paris, you know, having that great wander and the things that come to you by chance, etc. And I used to do that in a drive, you know, just drive.
It reminds me of the main character in that wonderful film, Ladybird.
I love it.
Well,
do,
there's
yes.
a scene, you get this lovely scene of the mother, and
yes.
then it sort of, and then suddenly it's the daughter doing
yes.
the same thing at the end.
Yes.
She leaves the place that she loathes, but actually she really loves it.
She loved it.
And when she drove through it, all of those things were present.
It really captured that spirit of, I know a lot of people who've done that, left their small town for the big
yeah.
city.
So after leaving with your master's...
Can
yeah.
I trace that a little bit,
yeah,
actually,
yeah.
from UCLA? Because UCLA, I finished in art history. I was asked to do a master's in art history there, and I said, no, I am going to be an architect. My teacher was very disappointed. He was English, John Tagg. He was disappointed, but it was a nice offer. But I knew I was heading toward architecture, so I went to work. One of the reasons my education took me so long was because I was also working, so I was getting work experience in an architect's office, which was fantastic, in a Neutra house in the Hollywood Hills.
When you go to somewhere that's really good, everything else sort of
yeah.
pales. You
yeah.
think, well, they don't.
It was. It
yeah.
was luck and a fantastic experience. But I knew also that I needed some technical help. There's only so much you can learn by tracing drawings and
sure.
being on the job site. I wanted my own. So I got a 2-year technical degree from what you would, in the States, we call it a junior college. Here, I think it's called
technical college.
Yeah, it's like going to a technical
yeah.
college. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I got a degree in It was called something like architectural drafting. So I was in school with a bunch of people who were not like me, and I thought there was a big hole in their education. I started the architecture club to do competitions and to take them out to cultural things in the city, which they wouldn't have had access to. Right. So that was really, it was fun and great. Anyway, and I finished that, and then I decided to get my master's, finally at SciArc, which I had seen for many years.
Back in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles. Mm. It's a school, it's a lot like the AA in that it's only a school of architecture. There's no other, no nothing else, no other arts, no liberal arts, nothing.
Does it have the same approach as AA? It's always been the one that's slightly more radical.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. It's similar in that way, but it was started by these guys that were teaching at a technical school, got fired for thinking too outside the box,
okay.
Brought a lawsuit against the school, got reinstated, quit, and started SciArc. So, that's a good spirit to it.
Very good.
Absolutely. And it was an amazing place, and I had a really diverse and wonderful class.
So when you left there,
finally,
instead of doing art, you actually assisted Mike Kelly, the artist, didn't you? As a sort of an assistant.
I did. He was someone whose work I'd always loved.
It's sort of sculptural, conceptual,
yep.
Kind of wild, actually.
Very wild.
I looked at some of his stuff and videos as well.
Very wild,
really
very disturbing. It was psychologically very disturbing.
Yes.
But I had seen a show of his, something flow chart, and it was a show. He had had a lot of shows in LA. LA really embraced him. And he was teaching at CalArts initially. And the show was about, he had collected stuffed animals from thrift shops that people had left behind, or he'd found them, and he categorized them on tables like they were scientific experiments. And something about it really moved me, and continues to, about Mike's mind, in that in all the kind of detritus of culture that you would think is just wasteland, he would use an incredibly analytical and smart brain to make it make sense in a way that brings up all the tensions about it. And I loved him from that moment. I had a friend who was working for him, and I said, hey, if there's any space in that project for me, I'd love to come and I'd love to just see what you're doing. And I went, and on that day I met Mike, and Mike offered me a job. And then eventually all the other people working on that project fell away, and I became the person in charge of it, which was fantastic. So I worked very closely with Mike to build a model of every single school he ever attended. And then he came in one morning, I came into the studio, and he had big drawings on top of the models, which were pristine at that point, all white foam core, all perfect, really, really perfect. He wanted these organic shapes cut in them so that we could see into the models, and we had already built in the rooms that he remembered. This is all about repressed memory syndrome. The rooms he remembered you could see into, and the ones he couldn't were blocked out, so the windows were blocked. And you could see, like, when he went to CalArts in this massive model, most of it he didn't remember. But the theory associated with it is that those places you don't remember are the sites of abuse. The models, these pristine architectural models, became the communication device for something so emotionally loaded. I mean, really heavy. And I just loved lending my architecture to an artistic idea or expression that was free, actually, from the idea about models being representative. The piece was to go to his gallery in New York, and I wanted to install it because I knew the most about the models at that point, even though he had an assistant to take it as well. But I really wanted to install it and make sure everything was right. And we went there, and literally before it was all out of its box, the Whitney bought the piece, like without seeing it all out. So it's now well taken care of by the Whitney.
He sadly committed suicide in 2012, actually.
Yeah.
Yes. But it sounds, by what you're talking about, these sort of deeply depressing backdrops. So you leave Mike after this project, and then you turn your attention to interviewing and, I assume, writing as well, because you got involved with Pierre Koenig's monograph.
That was a very strange and lovely thing to have happen. What happened was I finished the piece for Mike and building it, and I interviewed him and wrote about that piece because I was so fascinated with the use of architecture in an artistic way. And some people saw that piece, and someone from Fiden asked to meet me. And I met
person from Fiden who was looking for a commissioning editor. I ended up coming to London for an interview. I knew nothing about publishing at all, but I had given this person an amazing tour of Los Angeles. I mean, literally, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, Hollyhock House at midnight, you know, climbing over the fence and, you know, going to galleries and just, I gave them my kind of insider's tour of Los Angeles because I'd lived there for so many years. And then somehow convinced them that I knew what was happening on the West Coast, topically in design, art, architecture, fashion, etc. And Fiden was looking to expand what they were covering in the US besides just covering the East Coast, which was fairly well mined already. And they brought me in to really do that for them. But
and they brought you over here to London.
They brought me to London on a two-year work permit, yeah.
Right. That was a dramatic change. So at that point, presumably you thought, well, I'm not going to pursue pure architecture.
No, I was one exam away from finishing my licensing exam in architecture in the state of California. And I knew by leaving for this job in London, I might be abandoning it, that there was a chance.
Yes.
And it is, in fact, what happened. But I just thought, you know, these things don't kind of fall into your lap to... I always wanted to live in Europe, and I just thought, well, London's a start.
So how long were you with Fiden?
Not for the two years. Probably about 9 months, I would say.
A very short period of time.
Maybe a year, yeah, pretty short. Because it turns out that they were changing, their focus shifted in the after the time I was hired. They decided to go into the U.S. to do distribution, and they were not actually going to focus on commissioning. So I was kind of shouting into a long, dark tunnel. It was very frustrating. It just wasn't the right timing for me. So I left, and actually that's when I met Sam, just completely and purely by chance.
You were at an exhibition,
I was
apparently
at the Charles and Ray Ames exhibition at the design.
So it was kind of, you know, looking across the...
across the
crowded room. Was it one of those moments?
No, it was, it's a great story, but not exactly like that. I was brought to the exhibition by a friend of mine. He was brought to the exhibition by a friend of his. He was just in town from Tokyo. I had just been in London maybe 6 months.
You'd never met him before?
Never had met him before. I was downstairs listening to people talk about the Eames furniture, and I was really disheartened because this was furniture I grew up with. I knew very well. I knew the Eames story very well, and I found it, I felt like people were fetishizing it in a way that wasn't true to the work. And I went upstairs, and there was a temporary exhibition of some Epson printers, and I was looking at them, finding them really, the design of them really interesting. And a guy came up to me and said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Oh, this is really interesting." He said, "Which one do you like?" And I said, "This one." And he said, "Why?" And I said, I told him what I thought, and he said, "Oh, well, this guy designed it." Well, that guy was Sam.
Okay.
So Sam comes walking over, and he and I talked about his piece that was right there, and being Sam and I, we then walked away. And then an hour later, Sam and I were again away from our friends and literally bumped into each other on the staircase. He was coming up and I was going down. And I said, "Okay, obviously we're supposed to talk. Like, who are you?" In that very California way. And he said, and it turned out he wanted to talk to Fiden about a book. And I was in the need of an industrial designer to talk about a book proposal I had to, like, get an expert's opinion. So I said, "Well, why don't you come in to Fiden, and we'll have a chat. You can talk about your book, and I can ask you about mine." And that's how it started.
I see. Wow, what a great meeting of minds.
Yeah, it was great. It was great, and totally by chance.
What happened first? Did you become a couple? And
yeah, we became a couple first, and we started working together on the work that Sam was doing at IDEO, because Sam was head of product design at IDEO. He's brought back from IDEO Tokyo to IDEO London to be the head in London. So we started working on some of the projects that he was doing there. He was able to, there was a lot of freedom he had at IDEO to put together books and pamphlets and express some ideas in the work. And so I started working with him on that, including the Prada work that he did for Rem Koolhaas, the staff device. It was really great. It was the result of our thinking through these projects together. So we were having really long conversations about...
So your architectural mindset, if you like, and his mindset were beginning to...
Yeah, so but what was great is that he had always been interested in my discipline of architecture.
Yeah.
I was always open-minded about any other discipline, including fine arts. Mm-hmm. So I was, the cross-disciplinary thinking was already in us. But I think what we found is that my architectural thinking was, I think, helped to contextualize. It still does. I mean, we still use it that way. It helps to contextualize the projects. And industrial design thinking in that time was starting to think about things floating in white space, just form, you know, in white space. So these conversations were, the writing, I think, was trying to contextualize some of the work that was going on already. And so I think in terms of speed, we were very, very fast. We, looking back on it, it looks like we thought we knew what we were doing. I think we're just very lucky. It all just kind of fell into place for us. I think we met in 98, maybe? Through 98. Yeah, and we were married in 2000, and we started Industrial Facility 2002.
So it's 16 years ago.
Yeah.
And you decided to call it Industrial Facility, which is a very utilitarian, sort of anonymous name, as opposed to many companies that either use the names of the individuals or they give it a kind of fancy name.
It was a very purposeful rebellion against the kind of name game that was going on in design, and then still does go on to a certain extent. You know, for better or worse, we've paid for it, actually. It wasn't such a great decision, but it was conceptually right for us. We wanted to think of a name. First of all, we were going to be, obviously, a very small studio. It's just he and I starting out. But we really wanted to work for big industrial clients. So we thought, how are they going to think we're capable of this if it's just our two dinky names? It's
Does sound like a big warehouse.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. But let's make it sound, well, two things. Industrial has the objective of who we wanted to work with. And facility, it has two meanings, making it easy for industry and being a place that industry can happen. So we just really liked that. And we liked that it would be, didn't hinge on our personalities. It wasn't a personality-driven work. It wasn't ever going to be that. So it just made sense to us. But it's quite hard now because there are our names and there is the company name, and it's hard, you know, if somebody's making a product, they can't put all of that on into a product.
Sure. But I think you're synonymous with the name.
It's getting there.
I think most
it's
people,
getting there now. Not necessarily.
No,
not necessarily. And vice versa. If we speak at a conference and it's our names, they might not know, but they might know Industrial Facility.
Over that sort of 16-year period, you've designed so many different things, and I'm not going to begin to sort of go through them all, but I'm just going to list a few as we go. You've designed clocks, chairs, tables, printer. You've already mentioned that, but that was obviously outside of a fan, shirt, notebooks, pens, camera, coffee maker, knife, bottle openers, lamps, remote control, phones, bell, projector, toothbrush, you know, paper shredders, and so it goes on.
Yeah.
The common thread, looking at your work, the common thread that I feel that runs through is a kind of wonderful paring down to a kind of an essence. It's like you study the function of the thing, how it works, how it looks, where it's the environment is going to sit in, and then you just get rid of all of the flab, it seems to me. It's got a, you know, for example, I love the second phone because it's such a great, simple idea. You know, I think I heard you saying in a talk, when you look at these things in a room and you look at these kind of mobile phones, you have to stick them into a kind of cradle and there's all this wire everywhere and it's a complete disaster area.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't stand wiring, you know, all of this sort of stuff hanging out at the back of TV sets really, really bugs me. You know, I always get one of those things, you know, that you can put it inside,
a
tidy or whatever they're called, because at least that's less offensive than all this different kind of wire that has a life of its own.
Yeah.
So this lovely essence, which I looking at the work, and I know you've done a lot of work for Muji, but I also am a great lover of Japan. I've got a Japanese daughter-in-law and I've been there and I absolutely adore the Japanese. And I love the sort of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is sort of, and I see that in your work as it happens. I'm interested, you gave a talk a couple of years ago or maybe a year back and you talked about this Renaissance approach, which was the human-centered or human-centric approach where everything is made for the human. And then you pointed out that that's not the philosophy of Industrial Facility. It's really now putting all of the objects interrelating with one another because of the age we live in, where things talk. You know, I mean, I've got one of those Hive things, and it sort of does things while I'm out, you know, by itself. It just says, let's turn the heating on, because he wants it on now. So I found that very interesting. Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about that, because I found that very interesting, this whole idea.
I think we were, this is many years ago, we made these two models, the Renaissance model and the what we called dependence at the time. And the Renaissance model, we were trying to make an alignment between what became called human-centered design. Sounds like it makes a lot of sense, right? Putting people first, sales first or marketing first or anything else, but actually put people first. Okay, that makes sense. But when you follow that philosophically down the line, a couple of things happen. You can see a connection to humanism during the Renaissance period, where even when perspective was developed and the human was at the center, right? All the perspectival lines point to the person or to God or whatever they thought was the center. And we thought, well, that's really interesting, because actually we're saying the human is the center of everything. And yet there's a problem with that. And the problem is, if we're only thinking about people, it means we're not thinking about animals, we're not thinking about the planet, we're not thinking about the waters, we're not thinking about the universe, we're not thinking about anything beyond our personal needs. And we thought, that's just not right. That would be the cost of humanism, or the cost of human-centered design, and then it doesn't sound so good. So we made this other model where humans are on the same line as things and natural artifacts, right? So we should be considering all the natural phenomenon in our world, and we should be considering just all the things that we've made to work in the world. It's an ecosystem. And that also was a model for us of what the internet allowed for products to do. So as you say, it allows for products to talk to themselves. They don't any longer have to go through the human, because the human's not at the center anymore. They can just speak to themselves. So you can imagine in a sci-fi way that these things, you know, all of our fears about robotics and automated everything, products and environments, etc., they could take over, and then the human won't be at the center, and that would be terrible too, right? Mm. But really, we're trying to achieve more of a balance between how products operate, how people work with. We're trying to discover what those relationships are and propose them. And so when we take functions out of products, this is going back to your previous question, I guess. At first, it was in direct response to R&D departments trying to put as many functions into products as possible in order to kind of prime the pump for the next product that came, which would have that feature, because they found that 90% of people liked that feature, since it was marketing. So first we started to take them out, because we thought, well, that's great. R&D is probably winning, but are we as consumers winning? You know, we have to live with these things in our home environments, with a washing machine that has 20 buttons and 3 dials and 40 settings and etc. And then now, you know, talks to our temperature control or our phone or whatever else. Yeah. Like, do we really as people want that experience? Do we need that experience? Let's try to make the products have only what they need. And that way of thinking really influenced the second phone as well, because we don't need a cradle. We all have a horizontal surface to put the phone. Let's make it behave as if it acknowledges that we're living with other things. Mm. It doesn't. Every product you make does not have to be a world unto itself, an operating system unto itself, a language unto itself, a system unto itself. And I think we're reaching that point now where, even though we have internet-enabled things like the Hive or the Nest, or we have all these devices we can control with our phone, they all have different apps.
And often they all have different plugs.
Different plugs.
Which is the thing that drives you mental.
In the physical world, yes. They all have different plugs, and they have to, yes, exactly. But it's really complicated. So I think
every time I go to take my car in for service, I've always driven VWs, and I'm astonished that every time I talk to the guy about the latest model, it's got more things.
Yes.
You know, now it can actually stop you from crashing into things.
Yes.
It's got this kind
Sensors,
these sensors that will slow you down. And a dozen other things as well. Heated this, moving that.
I think they're getting us ready for self-driving.
Yes.
That's how I feel. They really are. I rented a car recently, and it had all this new technology in it. Because it's very easy to say, no, I don't want that. I want to park my own car. I want that feeling of control because we're used to that, right? We are used to having that control. We don't want to give it up to a machine or a computer or anything. But what I noticed in the rental car when I didn't have the chance to say, no, I don't want that function, etc., it's actually really great.
What, the self-parking?
Yeah, self-parking, the video camera that sees the sensors, the slowing down. If you're on cruise control, it actually now, on a California highway, if the car in front of you stops quickly, the car will stop itself.
Exactly.
If you haven't noticed in that split second. It's kind of incredible.
Yeah.
But I know where it's heading, right? It's heading so that they don't need us anymore at all.
No. And you won't need all the dials either, because it'll be under the bonnet or whatever, in a box.
You just don't. You don't need to even see them.
In fact, it could be in another room.
Yeah.
I'm interested to know the relationship between you and your clients, because listening to you talk about the relationship, you often refer to it more as a conversation. You use that word lots of times, which is a more intimate, you know, exchange of ideas. And from what you've just said just now, talking about how you work, is you can obviously be challenging to your clients, pushing them, or not pushing them exactly, but actually opening the horizons more to possibilities that they hadn't considered. Because as you say, most companies are about getting out there and do more of the same, but make it look a little bit better, rather than say why. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, having spoken to product designers before, there are two ways of work. You're either commissioned by a company, they will come to you and say, we like your work, would you work on this? Or you produce things off your own, you know, from your own imagination, and you can go to companies and say, we have done this, are you interested? Yeah. And both work. So tell me about that sort of thing. You know, the relationship between either self-generating stuff, and whether you do a lot of that or not, and the normal relationship.
Briefs. Yeah. Cutting briefs. I think when we started out, we didn't have any clients, so we had to make our own work and do exactly what you suggested, which is find either a new technology or a technology that had changed, gotten smaller, for instance, and offered an interesting opportunity, or work on an idea, like an idea for a phone that hadn't been addressed before, and just make something and then try to imagine who might be interested in seeing or thinking around that subject. And it never works. We try to tell this to students. It never works that you go to someone with something you think might be right for them and they say, yes, let's make that. They never do it. What they do is they see that you're capable of thinking in a certain way. And at least that's how it's worked for us. And then they've decided to come back to us quite often with the right project. So what they discover in that is that, hopefully, you don't think like the other people we know, and we need those people for this other work we're doing, but when we have the right project, we'd like to come back to you. And a lot of times they did come back to us, they did circle back, but it might have taken years, right? We needed the work right then, so it was a bit excruciating, but I think it was the right way around because it showed how we would move through a real project. It's just that we were setting the brief. And we didn't, by the way, imagine a brand and make something for that brand. Did not do that. No. We instead did the work and then thought, who might be
interested
in it?
And then chose
I think that was great. It was a great endeavor for us in the first place. We don't have much time to do that now because we just have too much work. And most often...
For you.
It did work.
Your
it did work
philosophy
in the beginning.
Works.
And I think if we always say if we do have any time, we do have things kind of on the back burner, like, let's work on that chair, or we are working on a chair that doesn't have a client because we have an idea. We are, and that's kind of, but it kind of has to just get the time as and when. It's not a priority because it doesn't have a client, and eventually we'll show it to somebody or somebody's, I guess. So yeah, there are those projects, so they're just not as often. But briefed projects are the things that we get most often, and those are really, that is when we often challenge our clients. We always challenge our clients, and I think the hardest part is working with someone for the first time, because they know already that we might challenge them, and they're open to that. They have to be. We're very frank about that we will raise questions outside of the brief. You know, are you comfortable? Yes, we want that. Yes, that's fine. Etc. Some are more open than others, meaning they all listen, but some of them actually act on some of the things, and some of them don't or can't. If you're working with a small company and you have a relationship with the CEO or the director or the family person who's responsible for the business, you've got a direct line to the person who makes the decisions.
And that's really important,
isn't
it?
And that is where, when you have byproducts from the work that aren't necessarily the project, that's where you have a chance. That's where the ears are most open, and that's the most exciting for us. And that aspect of our work builds relationships, or long-standing relationships, which has been great.
Yes, I think the relationship with the person that says yes or no.
Yes. It's key.
And is intelligent and has an open mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's fantastic. And you, on those occasions, you just go that extra mile.
Yeah.
Because you think this is special.
Yeah. Well, we do. We go the extra mile anyway. But sometimes it falls on deaf ears, you know.
Yeah.
Or it's often why when we present work, we make a book, we make something printed. And it's often so that whoever we're presenting to can then turn to someone else and present it without losing the vocabulary, losing the essence of the idea.
You actually make a little...
We actually make a little book or pamphlet
to give
with the... Yeah, we love
encapsulates
books.
Encapsulates, I'm sure you do, but it's a lot of extra work.
It is a lot of extra
work. And knowing by the quality of your work and, you know, your own monograph, which is beautifully designed.
Thanks.
Well,
really
on the topic of books, I've got a bone to pick with you.
Okay.
Now, I'm holding up...
Passport memo.
The Muji I use a lot.
Yes.
And... This is true. This happened to me last year. I was going to Spain, and I was going through passport control, and I pulled out my passport.
Oh, Mike.
And it was one of your...
Oh, Mike. Sorry.
No, but...
I didn't think about that.
I'm terrible at airports. I'm hopeless, because the moment I get in there, I feel, oh, my God, you've got to undress, take your shoes off, unbutton the belt, I'm going to leave stuff behind, which I've done before.
Oh.
And so I get completely... I'm not a good traveller.
Okay.
So I do this, and the guy goes, what is this? And then I can't find my passport. Actually, it's in the other pocket. It's there all the time, but I'm so panic-stricken. So I think they are so... You know, the size is so perfect, the colour is so perfect, it's really confusing.
Well, that's really interesting. They are purposefully exactly the colour, exactly the paper, exactly the same number of pages, exactly the radius of passports.
Yes, you should have a little warning sign.
But
this is not a passport. but they're great. I've got through so many of them. And I'm glad they brought them back.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave the main company now and move on to future facility, because I found that really interesting.
Okay, good.
That you are, you know, looking ahead. Mm-hmm. And there are two aspects of this. Another bit I'll talk about in a minute. But I was very taken by the project that you did for the Design Museum, which originally was called the Amazon Apartment, and then you had to change it because
of... Amazing, I call it Amazing.
You called it Amazing Apartment. Talk a little bit about that, because I thought that, you know, knowing that Muji, for example... Mm-hmm. You can buy a house from Muji in Japan. Mm. It struck me immediately, Muji should be doing this already.
Yeah.
You know, they're kind of, they're the only company I know, apart, I think IKEA now make a house. But I think Muji for a long time, they've made a house.
Yeah. We thought there was just a pure sense in Amazon, or a company like Amazon, who currently supply everything that goes in your house, that they would then very naturally... It would occur to them at some point to say, why don't we just make the house for our things to be in it? So it seems like a natural thing. We were asked to participate in that exhibition, the second version of New Old, and the premise was supposed to be products for the elderly population or aging population as it's growing, etc.
Yeah.
And we thought that was we had a real life experience that really inspired us to do the apartment. It really inspired how we thought about it. And that was that Sam's dad, who's in his upper 80s now, had to replace a washing machine, washing machine in his apartment. And we realized that he's completely vulnerable and at the behest of the service person who comes and tells him what he needs. And paying for that labor is very expensive, etc. And then you have to take their advice because you're no longer an expert. And if they tell you you need a part or a new machine, you do it. And again, it's a big financial burden. You don't know if it's a good decision or not. There's no moderation. So it kind of started to click with us that these appliances and the things that we live with that we buy initially to make our lives easier become a burden to us when we're older. So that machine is actually, while it's doing a great job doing the weekly washing, the lifespan of it, its maintenance over time, etc., becomes a burden, right? You can't. It's hard enough to take care of a flat or your provisions or your social requirements or your health requirements when you're older, but let alone navigating this world of consumer goods, which is changing because of the digital revolution, which they are excluded from. They're excluded from all the knowledge, all the trading, all the sharing of information that's on the internet simply because they're not on it. So they really can't navigate. And so that really pushed us to start thinking about appliances, what appliances will be not to be a burden, still to do their job, but not to be a burden in the future. What would they have on them? And then we thought, well, we combined it with this idea about Amazon providing the architecture. And I think the idea was to think about the Internet of Things, not just how things are talking to each other, but how things are provided for. So when you click and you buy a washing machine, someone, you still have to be home for it to be installed, etc. So by fantasizing about an amazing apartment block, we could say the whole apartment, or at least the service wall, which is what we built for the museum, a kind of...
So this is a void.
It's just a...
Behind the living space is a void with all of the machinery.
Exactly. So everything is serviced from... So your washing machine, the wall of washing machine, dryer, dishwasher, drinks dispenser, refrigerator, etc., all the appliances that are plugged in, they would be actually serviced from behind. So, and that is the service corridor where it's either robotically serviced or serviced by service personnel or whoever. So Amazon, who's providing the things, would actually be providing the whole wall and could trade in and out the entire wall. So they start to think, Amazon starts to think about products as pieces of architecture, right? And the person who's experiencing the apartment never sees the servicing. They don't have to be home. It's all part of the, they're never disturbed, etc. So it allowed us.
So presumably you just rent these things because they could be updated very easily.
Yeah, you just has it.
And it's serviced by.
Yeah. You don't have to specify what... I mean, the whole block could probably have the same appliances, and no one, you know, maybe you could say blue or gray or white or whatever. But, you know, these things are built in and then replaced in and out from behind. So, I mean, when we showed it in the museum, the appliances themselves look very, very stark and very minimal because literally you need one button. You need to maybe say on. And that's it.
Yeah.
But you can put your clothes, you know, in these new machines, you can put your clothes in, it weighs it.
Recognizes the fabric.
Recognizes the color, the sensors and the scanners are there. And so therefore you're renting a living situation, not a place, not a home that is an accumulation of separate warranties, service equipment,
sounds like
everything.
Bliss.
It sounds like bliss. You
it
have
sounds
no
like
worries.
Bliss. Because there are so many damn things that you have to get sorted.
Yeah.
Now, I'm interested to know that... We started out by talking about your meeting with Sam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it strikes me that working together, living together, married, so forth, is quite a tough call. I mean, 24 hours a day.
Yep.
How do you... I mean, obviously, you know, you're very matched, but what do you do to get away... No, I'm not saying what do you do to get away, but do you get away from thinking about what you're doing during the day? And if so, what do you do? I mean...
Mostly, we probably do even that together. The getting away part is definitely in any landscape. So any countryside, away from city, away from London.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So long walks, away, new landscape, that does it for us. Together or separately, I would say. Do we need to do that? I think we need to do that to sustain the level of and the pace of thinking that we have and the intensity that we have in our relationship. And because I think we talk about, people say, oh, do you talk about work all the time? Well that is all the time. Yes.
Well, I mean, most designers that I know, and I include myself, when people say, well, what do you do when you're not working? I say, I'm just always being me,
right, exactly.
Thinking. So
exactly.
They don't get, most people think you have to.
Turn it off.
I
no,
enjoy
you don't.
It.
No,
you,
you
know.
Don't. No, I think there are two ways you can do it. My dad once told me that you can either work so that you can have time and the fluency to enjoy the things that you like outside of work, or you can make the work the thing that you love.
Yes. Right?
And I'm lucky enough to do the latter.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
And then in terms of getting away individually, I'd say exercise, running or cycling. Yeah, that's alone time, probably. That's time without conversation or maybe private conversation. But I think even on the landscape, we're walking and talking about work.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is.
Now, I always end these interviews really... Well, actually, I'm going to end it anyway, but and I'm going to ask you whether you have any pearls of wisdom to young designers. But what just struck me is that I don't recall many women, actually. All the key people that I know are all men.
Yeah.
So this is kind of an exception.
It's a tough one. It's so tough. I am often the only woman in the room.
Yes.
It's always been that way. Isn't that also similar in architecture?
You're the only woman in the room here as well, by the way.
Yes, and I am in the studio and I am at my house as well, actually.
Right.
It's a good thing I've always liked men, yes. It's very lucky.
But why do you think that is? What is...
Oh, I just don't know. I try to think when I teach. I teach at ACAL in the Master's Product Design. It's the first time I've taught in product design. I used to teach in architecture. But I try to think, you know, what can I offer these women that can help them actually get to the profession? Because often it can be 50-50 in education, and then you go forward and... You know, somehow the women just drop out of the profession. But they might have had the same education as the men, or it might have been balanced numbers there. So how can they stay? How can I encourage them to stay? What do they need to hear or see? And I think, I don't know the answer to that. But I know for me, seeing Doreen Nelson when I was 11, and she wasn't the only woman, but she was definitely in charge. She was definitely inspiring in the kinds of questions that she made. So I think... By example, I can only think that, I mean, the only thing I can manage is by example, you know, be exemplary in how you deal with people and the kind of work that you do. It's really, I've always had that pressure on myself anyway, but I feel like there's even more of a responsibility. I need to be honest. I need to be quite strong. I need to push myself to say something when I'm thinking it, because there were a lot of years that went by that I was thinking it, but couldn't say, you know, can't say it, or but I'm also very careful not to say what's already been said. If it doesn't need to be said, I'm certainly not going to chime in and say something.
Say a little bit then about potential young designers that you know, want to get into this world. What would you say to them? What should they be doing? What should they be thinking about?
Yeah.
What should be they should be looking at?
All those things.
It's quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, they have to look extensively. You know, they have to be curious. If they're not curious, they're not a designer. They have to be niggled by something and driven to make it better. Something. It could be anything. I mean, the things that annoyed me don't annoy me anymore, for instance. But as long as you're annoyed by something, you know, you see a problem that... just isn't right, you know, or an injustice in either in a thing or in a relationship or in any way, that energy can be really good, that kind of angry energy, the lack of being satisfied. You know, a lot of kids now are coming out, millennials, etc. They're kind of like satisfied with their lot, very, very complacent. And
yeah.
They're just kind of, that's the way it is. Not really active. So I would say to be a designer, you have to be driven and curious and follow the things that interest you, even if you don't know why they do. My dad and I used to go to swap meets in Los Angeles, flea markets in Los Angeles, you know, 5 a.m. in Long Beach on a weekend. It's really fun. And he once said to me, I followed you around. I cannot figure out why. Why did you pick up that figurine? Or why did you pick up that lamp? Or what were you looking at? I mean, they're just really ugly. I said, I know. Isn't that fascinating? Someone actually made that.
So that's basically curiosity.
That's
top
curiosity
of the list.
But it's not just like for beautiful things.
Yeah.
It's also for mistakes or,
yeah,
you know, weird cultural output. You know, just that's why I say think wide. You know,
yeah,
keep your eyes open. You might think you're interested in product design, but actually, if you just follow what you love, and it might turn into be actually graphic design is what you really love, or it could be fine arts, or it could be, you know, you could turn your back on it and become a doctor. You know, follow your path, whatever that is, and The second thing I would say is my mom, because she's a psychologist and it comes naturally to her, she always has lots of pearls of wisdom. And she used to say to me when I was really struggling, I think struggling in my mind, you know, intellectually struggling with things and creatively struggling with things. And she said, well, if it's really difficult, it's not meant to be. And I said, that's not true. If it's really difficult, that's the good work. You know, that's the work one should be doing. And to a certain extent, both are true. You know, I couldn't have just done the things that were easy to me and been satisfied. But equally, the anger that I and the dissatisfaction doesn't drive me as much as it used to either. And that could be because I'm later in my career now, and I think easier is not so bad, actually.
On that note, we'll end the interview. Kim Cullen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Nice to talk.